Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hi, Anna.
Hi, Shireen. This is Ethnically Ambiguous.
Yes, we have a very good episode today with Cerise Castle. She is a reporter, investigative journalist. She's doing such important work. I'm so excited for y'all to get to know her a little bit better.
Yeah, so stay tuned and enjoy the dulcet tones. You'll get understand why I'm making fun of KZRW later.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, Shireen.
Hello, Anna.
How's it going?
Well, you know, I know this is like ludicrous to say during this time, but I'm actually doing well.
My birthday was yesterday.
Yeah. I can't believe I'm saying that out loud. Sorry that if I'm triggering anybody, but I'm doing good.
And happy day after your birthday day.
Thank you. Yeah, my birthday was yesterday. I had a really nice day. When I got to San Diego, where my parents are, it had been about 15 days since I got the vaccine, and I just got the one and done shot. So
J&J.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I've been happy ever since I got the vaccine. Like, it cured like 3% of my depression, which is a big deal. And when I got home and I was vaccinated and my parents got their first dose, it was just like, I was just so happy to be around my family. And like, I hugged my mom for the first time and like, without freaking out with a mask on, mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't know. I had a very nice day, very naturey, walked a lot with my mom, who I'm obsessed with, if anyone forgot. But yeah. And so many of the listeners gave me really nice birthday messages and birthday posts. So it was really, really nice.
Nice.
Including you. Yeah, you had a great birthday post on our Instagram. I loved it so much.
Your 50th birthday.
Yeah.
Wow. And for context, yeah. It's because Shireen did one of those, like Instagram filters that's like, how old are you? And it said she looked 50, which is just absurd.
Yeah. And my face during it was just so, like, I purposely didn't like make an expression. Yeah. So I was just like, how old am I going to be? And then it just said 50 and I just had to take a screen grab.
It was absurd because also you like don't even look like your actual age. Like you look younger than your actual age. So it's
Thank you. I really need to hear that because I feel ancient, but you know.
Classic 50-year-old behavior.
I know. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I have nothing new.
Cool. let's bring in our guest.
Yeah, let's bring in our guest. It's more important than like me being like, I've sat for a week. Okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I'm really excited to talk to our guest. She has done some really important work, especially recently. You probably might have heard of her.
Yes. We have a great guest. You may have heard of her. You may have heard of her because she's killing it. Yeah. And I say it so aggressively because her work is actually that important right now. And like, yeah. I feel like I've been waiting. She recently dropped something that I've been waiting for. I feel like I've been screaming on my Twitter about what she wrote about. So much so I got into a fight about it with my dad. Not recently. Like, during the holidays. And yes, I went home for the holidays because my family is flagrant and all caught corona. So they all had antibodies so I could see their, you know, flagrant asses walking around with their corona. Right. Sorry, mom and dad. And so my dad sometimes listens
kidding.
And sometimes he gets upset about
I'm
things.
Kidding.
So we got to be like, sorry.
Right.
Sorry you went to Iran and caught COVID. What do you want me to do? Anyway, I got into my fight about my dad. I literally brought up something that she's writing about. And then he was like, oh, really? And I'm like, yes, this shit's happening. Because no one knows. Because no one wants to report on it. Yeah. Except for the guest, okay? If that's not been a strong enough intro. We have reporter. We have investigative journalist. Cerise Castle is here.
Yes.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you for
sitting by while we talk to each other.
while I scream at my father.
I related so much of what was just said.
Oh, thank you.
I was just laughing to myself.
I mean, yeah. The piece you wrote on the LASD, Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, it's called A Tradition of Violence, which is all about the deputy gangs in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. California. Truly like long time coming investigative piece. Long time coming because it's not spoken about enough. And yeah. It's surreal. Like
it's really not.
Yeah. Like it's one thing to kind of know that the LA police are fucked up and stuff. And it's one thing to know that like there's a history of racism and like violence and all of that. But to see it like broken down the way you did it was so, it was just like, yeah, as Anna said, like a long time coming and like just finally it's here to like, one, to just like to show people if they just want to know. But I thought it was so well written and so well done. So
thank you so much
for doing that very important work.
It's truly my pleasure. It's something that I had thought about and wanted to read myself for probably my whole life. I've heard about deputy gangs. Mm-hmm. I think for the first time I heard about like an actual like gang with a name and everything was when I was like 12 years old from my brother. But it had always intrigued me and there was never anything written about it. Mm-hmm, yeah. I remember going to the library just like at different points in my life growing up, trying to find like news articles about them or like even a book just sort of like detailing like gangs and police departments, and there was nothing. So the circumstances were presented as such where I was able to just sort of sit back and do research for a number of months. And this is what came out of that research.
It's an article with 13 parts or 12?
We're up to 17 now.
17.
Just because of the sheer amount of information that I've received from people as the articles have been released, I've extended the series just in order to incorporate some of that information. And obviously I'm going to continue reporting on this once the series concludes, but some of the information was just so crucial it needed to be included.
Yeah. I mean, that's like a great element of doing something that's an ongoing investigation, right? Like because it hasn't really been reported about, when you talk about it, it's probably going to be incoming information from people that are like, I know about this. Here, I can give you some information.
It's interesting because we're all very used to the social media lingo of like ACAB, #ACAB, all cops are bastards, you know, police brutality, police killing innocent black men in the streets. I mean, for the most part, we're aware of this. I feel like the problem is we're not aware is like the gangs, like, yes, the police are bad, but there's even more layers to that of like, but there's gangs within the police that perpetuate further violence because a part of being in that gang is to complete certain tasks that make you eligible. I hate that I'm even saying these kind of things.
Yeah.
That make you eligible to be a part of that gang. So it's like on top of pure just violence and racism and, you know, horrific behavior, you now have another layer of asking these police officers to continue acting like this in order to have some sort of like badge of honor. Like it is so, it's convoluted and it's terrifying.
It's like the worst kind of, like, it's like a disgusting fraternity, honestly. Like, it's just like this bros club and the narrative that so many people still believe, it's like, oh, it's a few bad apples. It's like, no, it's completely enmeshed in the police like foundation, this like very disgusting like brotherhood mixed with like fraternity gross hazing shit that a lot of the time puts marginalized people at risk, if not like fatally, you know. It's just like, it really disgusts me beyond no belief. But we're starting here already, but
that's scary.
First of all, great use of your pandemic time, if I can say that. Like best use of pandemic time I've ever heard. Meanwhile, here I am, like, just doing shrooms all the time.
I mean, that happened too. Like,
yeah, sometimes you must go further.
Yeah,
mentally, you must push to discover.
But yeah, so you mentioned that you had time, so you started this very extensive research project. But what was the response? Like, what did you? Were you surprised by the response and how it was received, or what was that like for you?
The only thing that's really surprised me has just been how quickly deputies themselves have approached me.
Okay.
And said that this is something that I've tried to raise on my own within the department, and I've either lost my job or I've had to, you know, like leave quietly. I've been pushed out, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what really surprised me. I really hoped that by writing this, people like that would feel comfortable approaching me. And I've been really happy that it's happened so quickly. And really the thing that they say the most often is that my reporting is just scratching the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I've written a 17-part series, that's always what they say to me. Like, oh, this is just the beginning. You're really just opening Pandora's box.
Wow. Right. Has there been any sort of threatening behavior towards you?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. I received death threats after a couple of stories that I've done. This one, it hasn't been as intense as I thought it would be.
Okay.
But I think that's because the department hasn't really acknowledged the series itself.
Okay.
But I did leave my house for 2 weeks and went off the grid.
That's good.
I'm hoping that things continue to, you know, be low key, because, you know, the harassment and intimidation tactics that these deputies engage in, it's very real. I talk to families every day that have lost family members at the hands of these people, and the killers of their sons and daughters will drive by the house and, you know, pull them over for no reason and detain them for 16 hours at a time. The risk is very real. So I, you know, stay in my house and try not to engage with them as best as I can.
Yeah.
And there's something that happened in your past that I will touch on later, but I was actually scared because I was like, you are putting yourself in a vulnerable position because of what these stories cover and the situations these deputy gangs have put people in, that I was like, you're potentially, in my mind, one of the bravest people I've ever come across, which is kind of like why I was like, well, we got to get her on these shows. We got to be talking to her. Like, this has to be a thing that people are talking about, because the more awareness... that I think is important, because that protects you in a way, because the more people know about it, the less they can get away with doing shady shit or scary shit.
That's been my girlfriend's strategy with this entire thing.
And that's, I mean, like, important. Especially just like the history of the government literally targeting like Black and brown people, like throughout time, especially those that are outspoken. It's a scary position to put yourself in, but it's extremely brave. So I commend you again for choosing to do that with your pandemic time and just your life. But I have a question. So when these deputies approach you about you're barely scratching the surface and stuff, are they willing to like give you information and like be honest about it? Or is it still kind of like for like a brotherhood pact or some shit?
The ones that approach me are very willing to give information because, frankly, they've just been so screwed. By the department.
Are they still working? Or
some
are they
of
like,
them are. Some of them are still working. Some of them are not. Trying to be careful with what I say.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I just wanted to know if like how deep the fear went. Like, I wonder, I was just curious if they were also afraid to themselves at risk.
Yeah. I mean, the fear is very real. I mean, one story that I covered that was released today is about seven deputies that worked at the East Los Angeles station, which is the home of three different gangs that we know about. And leading up to this big fight where they were, a couple of them were cornered and attacked by Banditos members, they had been, you know, knocked out behind the station. They had been sent out to these dangerous calls and hadn't been given backup. Even one time, the Banditos, like trying to like set this guy up, they unloaded all of the ammunition from his gun and then like sent him off on a dangerous call.
Jeez.
So, you know, they're very afraid. Yeah, I've written about deputies that have had their home shot at while their children were asleep in the room.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's very risky. Like, the danger is very real.
But like, to do that to, in quotes, one of your own, you know, like that's so... it's just disgusting. Like, you have to abide by these freaking like hazing shit or you're dead. Like, it further proves that there's no fixing it from the inside. You know, it just further proves that it's not a few fixes, and it's definitely not more money.
I mean, I think that's the problem. It's so deep. It goes mm-hmm. so deep because now it's like that the system has existed for so long that they've created their own like reasoning as to why this is okay.
Yeah.
And it's like, go fuck yourself. That's my only thing is go fuck yourselves. That is what the
yeah,
fuck?
Yeah, truly.
Okay. There's no humanity well, left.
Let's get to know you a little bit yeah. better. Let's rewind. Tell us where you were born and where you were raised.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting story. I was born I was born in Irvine, California, which is a very boring suburb in Orange County. And I was raised, man, all over, really. I lived with my dad in Corona del Mar for the first like 8 years of my life. Corona del Mar is a sundown town or was a sundown town until the mid 80s.
What does that mean?
A sundown town is a town that had a law on the books that didn't allow Black people to stay past a certain time, past the sun going down.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So basically they could kill you. I mean, hopefully you'd just be arrested, but they could kill you.
Yes.
It was a sundown.
It was a sundown town, I believe, until the mid-1980s.
Wait, what?
Oh my yeah. God, I did not know that about Corona del Mar.
I did not know it was that modern. That is
yeah.
That is awful.
Yeah. So that's where I spent my formative years.
That sounds great.
with my dad, who's a bald white guy. He passed away when I was 8. And then I went to live with my mom for a few years, and she lived in Costa Mesa. My mom and I have a very, very bad relationship. And she was abusive to my brother and I growing up. So I moved out of that home and lived with, I was like taken in by different families, and I lived with different families for extended amounts of time from the time that I was like 9 through 17, I want to mm-hmm. say. And then at that point, I was on my own and I lived in Huntington Beach, California, which is like currently like ground zero for the fucking KKK. Yeah.
Wow. You just went from a sundown town to Huntington Beach.
Yeah. Yeah. So wow. I grew up around a lot of white supremacy yeah. and that informed a lot of the things that I do.
Yeah. I mean, and those are very formative years, like the first 8 years of your life, and then from 9 to 17 to just like be moving around and the constant moving as a child, as a preteen, as a teenager. How did that influence yourself and your like what you wanted to accomplish? Like, what was that experience like?
It really, gosh, it gave me a lot of identity crisis. I was never around a lot of like other Black people growing up. The first family I lived with was Japanese and Italian.
Okay.
I have this like very like treasured memory of like having probably one of my first like very real conversations about race with the mother. She was a Japanese woman. She was mixed race, Japanese and Indigenous American. That was probably like one of the only like real conversations I had about race with like an adult.
Wow.
And following that, I lived with white people, which I guess like looking back on it was unusual, and it made me feel like insecure a lot, I would say. And like going to like white schools and, you know, like always being the only Black kid, it gave me a lot of insecurity. I like dealt mm-hmm. with a lot of, I wouldn't say bullying, but like racially charged, like racist yeah. behavior. Racist like harassment from other students.
Yeah.
And I didn't really like, I wasn't like going home to anywhere where I could like really talk about it and mm-hmm. make sense of it.
Were you with your brother throughout this whole time, or did you guys get separated?
No. My brother, he lived with my grandmother, our grandmother, for, let's see, from the time I was like 8 to 12, and then he's a lot older than me. He's like 8 years older. Oh. So then he was in college and on his own.
Wow, that sounds very isolating.
Yeah, it was. It was.
Is there a reason why you chose not to go live with your grandmother?
Well, my mother kind of isolated us from the rest of the family as like par for the course of like a bunch of other like shitty abusive things that she did. So once she had like cut off contact, I didn't have contact with my grandmother for 10 years.
Wow.
My grandmother came back into my life because I had attempted to apply to college and just like get the hell out of California because I had had such a traumatic experience. And my mother didn't want me to go. So she like refused to, you know, you have to like fill out the FAFSA and everything. Mm-hmm. And she just like refused to give over the information that was needed.
Wow.
So the family that I was living with at the time, the mom, she found out about this and she found out that I wasn't planning on attending college or anything.
Yeah.
And she was horrified. So she reached out to my grandmother. She tracked down my grandmother, reached out to my grandmother and told her what was going on. And she had us meet up and my grandmother told me that she would pay for the first semester of college in full and, you know, like help me get set up with scholarships and everything. And that's how I was able to attend college.
That's
amazing.
God bless your grandmother.
Yeah. Yeah, really. She's really cool.
And that woman, the woman that you were living with for even taking that initiative. Yeah. I'm glad that you had at least two women in your life that were interested in helping you in your future because it brought you where you are today.
Yeah.
I think this is a great place to take our first break. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. We are back.
Okay, so where did you end up going to college?
I went to Emerson College. It is a small, fartsy school in Boston. I think it was voted the year I went like the most hipster school in the United States and the second most LGBT friendly school. I think we were number one that year.
Oh, nice.
LGBT friendly school in the United States.
I will admit that there is a lot of Emerson kids in LA and a lot of them that I meet are very hipster. Like I was surprised when you said Emerson. I did not mark you as an Emerson girl, but yeah.
Really?
No, my gosh.
I was like the Emerson girl at the time.
That's funny.
I was on the Emerson fashion page and all kinds of shit.
Thriving. Well, was part of it just like this intense desire to leave California too? Like, were you just like really ready to call somewhere else home?
Oh yeah. I hated like my life at that point.
Yeah.
And I just like really wanted to make a new one. So I thought the best way to do that was just getting as far away as I could from what I had before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But now going, because Boston, not exactly the most person of color friendly.
So I was going to say you went somewhere kind of white. Yeah.
So what was that experience for you like in Boston?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Boston was like terrible. My only experience with Boston leading up to that point was watching the movie Miracle, which I had seen on a field trip in the middle school. Kind of weird, but that was my only frame of reference for Boston. I never visited the school or anything. Mm-hmm. So I got there and the first night I was in Boston, I had met up with some kids from this Facebook group that had been set up for, or it might have been set up by another Black student. And he had just sort of found all of us in the freshman class and put us in a Facebook group. And a couple of us that have been very active in the group, we all met up. Naturally, we went to go smoke some weed. Mm-hmm. And while we were out in the park smoking weed, a white man with a dog approached us and called us niggers.
Jeez.
And told us to get the fuck out of the park.
Jesus.
And chased us out of the park. And that was my first night in Boston.
Your first night in Boston.
Yes.
That is traumatic. I mean, you already experienced so much trauma, but to like have this like new home that you're trying to make into, just to, that is damn.
Wasn't the first time we were chased out of a area by white people either.
Wow. And it was just some guy with a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And to like you, call man. A bunch of kids a racial slur, it's like, why? You're kids. Give me a break, you weird. I mean, you shouldn't call anyone a racial slur, but also like that's your first instinct.
Yeah.
It's like, I'll just like attack these kids. Oh my God.
Fuck that guy. I hope he's dead. But okay,
all right. Yeah.
But okay. So when you went to Emerson, when you applied to college and everything, what were you thinking of studying?
Journalism. Always journalism. That was the first job. That's the only job I ever remember wanting. And I came to that conclusion when I was in the eighth grade and I took a field trip to Washington, D.C. And as a part of that trip, we went to New York and we went to the set of, I think it was Good Morning America. And we stood in the square and everything, you know, did the whole bit. And the anchors came out to talk to us. I remember it was Ann Curry who came out and I was talking to. And I loved her because, you know, here's like a woman of color, like anchoring the news.
Yeah.
And I watched her every morning. So I was starstruck and she like came over and talked to me. So I was just like dazzled. Mm-hmm. And she asked me, you know, oh, like, what are you studying in school? Where do you go to school? What do you like? And I was just telling her like, oh, I love to write. I love history. Like, that's been my favorite part of this trip. And she was like, oh, well, you might want to consider being a journalist. And I was like, okay, great. Like, yeah, I'll be a journalist. Yeah. Yeah. So I went home and I started getting into journalism, started subscribing to the newspaper and just like reading the newspaper religiously and following different like news programs and watching them every night. And I've been doing it ever since.
Wow.
That's cool. Ann Curry. Wow.
Yeah. I wonder if she knows that that like comment that probably was just like, like, just like, you know, like a comment you tell a kid or something. Like, maybe yeah. she didn't think too much about it, but it changed the trajectory of your whole life, you know?
It
I would
did.
Love for you guys yeah. to meet and have the story be exchanged.
Me too. I would love that. I had a similar experience. Robin Roberts actually spoke at my college graduation.
Cool.
And there's a video somewhere of me getting out of line to, like, run her down. Sitting in, like with the teachers and just be like, Robin, like I literally went to journalism school like because of like people like you, like mm-hmm. watching you every day. And she was like, I think like both like shocked and flattered. She was like, oh, thank yeah. you. But yeah, whenever I have those opportunities, I take them no matter how creepy I may appear.
Well, I'm excited for that one too. That opportunity will come up with Ann Curry. I 100% yeah. know it. Especially with like just your work is bringing like it's just important enough and so singular that I think you're on a trajectory that is just the same thing that they're doing. You know, it's just you're going to, it's almost like, I don't want to say this out loud because it sounds so silly, but like you're going to be a household name. That's what it feels like you're going to be, you know.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I hope so.
You me know, too.
I you know, with the way mainstream media is going, it's so scary. They're like so up their own ass and don't really have any ability to critical think about anything. I don't know, but I hope like as we keep pushing, you know, like as like more young minds, if you will. Am I still young? I don't know. I'm 30. It's hard to say like where I stand, you know? I do have yeah. a middle part though now, baby. What's up? I'm staying yeah. young.
I can't pull off a middle part. Oh. I have a weird off-centered widow's peak and my face is too, it like accentuates how asymmetrical my face is. I can't do it.
Yeah. It fell that way one day and I was like, God, I'm so tired. Who cares? And that's like more to my age of like, I don't even have the energy to find my side part again. But right. Yeah, like I just hope that we just were able to keep pushing. Mm-hmm. So like people like you, reporters like you who are doing work that like we, our generation is like, fuck yes about, we can just help shift the cultural consciousness. I don't like, what are these mm-hmm. buzzwords I'm saying, but like I hope we can like do something. And you know, part of it's yeah. also like putting pressure on like establishment Democrats of like, fucking stop, you guys are losers, you know. Like, so mm-hmm. I scream in there, you almost want to like bully them, but like, you know, you shouldn't. But like at the same time, it's like we need should. To change because this is like your status quo of like bringing in Biden and being like, see, everything's okay again. The racist monster is gone. It's like, no, it's not. We're all still suffering. Income inequality is an all-time high. Nothing's changed. You idiots. Give people health care. And it's like, I want us to just keep pushing the pressure, man. And then like people like you can take over and you're reporting about real shit. Like, look at these fucks, you know? And you know what? That's a good pivot point. I want to talk about your experience at KCRW because I feel like, look, I came to LA.
Anna, that was so like Oprah of you. That was very just, that was beautiful to watch.
I have so much anger. I have genuinely so much anger since the pandemic started. And I just have to read the news every day for Daily Zeitgeist that I'm like a, I am truly like a, one of those like pots, the top's like shaking, like boiling. Just wait till I'm out, baby. When I'm out on the streets, I'm
full rage,
you know, outside of like, you know, being out literally like protesting, but like what I'm really just so angry about. But I want to talk about KCRW because when I first moved to LA, KCRW was so cool and hip. Like, that's the news you want to listen to. And I do, whatever. I listen to NPR and the KCRW. I'm like, oh, morning does become eclectic. Now I'm like, go fuck yourself, Jason Bentley. And
morning becomes eclectic.
And what is it? Ann Lit. That's a white feminist. Okay. I've learned. Okay.
For the first like 3 years I was here, I thought her name was Ann Lick. And I was like, ew, I don't like hearing this person's name.
To the Hollywood Bowl shows. Okay. Like I've been there. I've been around the LA block. I'm 30 now. I've been here since I was 22 making my mistakes. Yeah. I have learned a lot. But
like, do you remember when everyone had those like sweatshirts and mugs, and if you didn't have or a tote, and it was almost like the sign of like
keychain on your thing? I donated.
It's like a sign that like elitist learning. That's like
we've come a long way. And so when you came out about your situation, which we'll get into detail about in a second, I was like, yeah, I mean, like we shouldn't be holding up these establishments like on this pedestal because we don't know what they're doing. Yeah, all the names I just mentioned are all white people. Okay. So before I keep like literally insulting like DJs on that, you know, whatever. And yes, Chris Doritas does have a very shady drugging a youth, a 17-year-old, I believe, at an LA bar.
14.
She was 14. Okay, sorry about my numbers wrong.
14-year-old child. Yes.
So
the Chris Doritas with the smooth voice on the radio? That Chris Doritas?
The Chris Doritas who fills in for Jason Bentley after Jason took over. Okay, like, fuck that guy. So let's make that very clear. Look into it. Google it. Information's out there. That's crazy. Why is that man still have a job?
Yeah.
But
why did the station say in an LA Times article, we stand by Chris?
Wow.
And we trust his character.
Good question. Why?
They're contrast all, that.
That's enough
with
to just
how they talked about me.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. Which is what I was telling Shireen beforehand. KCRW doubled down on I am again jumping ahead. So when did you start working at KCRW?
Oh man, when did I start working at? I had my first training, I believe, in July of 2019.
Okay.
Okay. So can you kind of give us a rundown of what your experiences were like while you were there?
Yeah. So a lot of the things that you said about like KCRW being like cool, like news, like the station, like you want to listen to as far as NPR, like 100%. Like I grew up here. So like I grew up like listening to KCRW and I grew up wanting to be a journalist. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of always wanted to work for like a hometown institution. There's always been that part of me. So when I saw KCRW had an opening for an afternoon news producer, I jumped at it. I was coming off of Vice News Tonight, which had just been canceled over at HBO. Mm-hmm. So I was coming from the world of television where six-figure salaries are standard. Mm-hmm. And I made the decision to go into the world of nonprofit journalism, which is a huge step down, financially speaking, but one that I was willing to take and just something that I want to speak to because like as a Black queer person in this field, like making the conscious choice to earn less. Mm-hmm. I just think is something that should be acknowledged. Mm-hmm. So I got the job and I was really excited to work there. I felt like a little kid on my first day of school when I first drove to the station. And pretty quickly after that, I was stopped at the door and asked to identify myself. This was after I had started working there, like after about a week.
Wow.
I was asked to like stop and identify myself and like show my badge and everything. The first time I just sort of brushed it off because, you know, that's like what we're trained to do. So I didn't really make a big deal out of it. But that became a regular thing, getting stopped on my way into work. Only me, to my knowledge.
Yeah.
Crazy thing about that is that I would also always get mixed up with the one other Black woman that worked there.
Wow.
We don't look anything alike.
Of course not. Like, it's just, obviously we're going to get into how trash in NPR KCRW are, but like, they're lauded as this like very progressive institution. And so to know that behind the scenes, they're confusing their two Black employees and like always asking for identification. It's just like, it's all a fucking scam. It's all just like a facade, but people buy into it. And that's what's upsetting.
Yeah, people really do. There were tons of little things. I mean, like the host that I worked with, his name is Larry Perel. Mm-hmm. Like he regularly questioned my intelligence, regularly disparaged me and my work performance. One of his favorite things to say to me was, I don't feel like you want to be here.
God,
which again, like calling back to that financial point, like I very much did want to be there. It was quite literally a lifelong dream to work at KCRW, and it very quickly became a nightmare.
Wow. I mean, the fact that there's only two Black women and you're confusing them, that, I mean, outside of confusing them, there's only two Black women that work there. Yeah. Like, what are you doing? And then it's like, you don't want to be here. You're asked to identify yourself every time you walk in. After a while, you're like, well, that's not worth it. But yet I'm still here.
Yeah.
You think I'm the other girl. That like, I'm still here. Like, that's fucking rude.
It's like they're telling you they don't want you. And like, it's like he's projecting what he's thinking in his head. Like, I don't really want her here. And I'm going to tell her. It's like a reverse psychology almost, you know? It's just disgusting, to be honest. But so how long were you working before you were like, I've had enough, I need to leave and or speak out?
I wasn't sure about leaving until I signed the document. There's a lot to get into here.
Right. There is one point I actually want to touch on before we get here is you had an incident where you were shot by rubber bullets? I don't even know what they are. What are they supposed to be? I don't know.
Great questions, all of
them.
They're
bullets.
I don't really have many answers.
Yeah.
They're less than lethal munitions.
Yes.
They
okay.
can kill you.
Right. Yeah. So you were shot with one of those.
Yeah, I was shot with one of those. KCRW didn't want me there covering that protest. I'll say that.
Okay.
I went anyway because I felt like it was a historical moment and my instincts, they usually are right with news.
I think
they were right again.
Yeah, I think so.
So they were, very happy I was there when I was there. And they cut to me many times. And yeah, I was supposed to go live with Warren Olney. And as I was waiting for him to say, and talk me in, we're here with Cerise, LAPD rolled up. I don't even know if they were LAPD.
Yeah.
Law enforcement rolled up in one of those trucks that they hang off the back of.
Right.
And they jumped off and they started shooting. There was no order to disperse, no nothing. They started shooting. And I've covered dicey situations before, and I've gone through training for journalists for what to do when you're in a situation like that. And my training is to, identify yourself as press and get to either a sergeant, a press information officer, someone in charge, basically, and present yourself. And as I was attempting to do that, a police officer, I have photos of this, turned, pointed his gun at me and shot me. And it was horrible. I had to limp away and take cover. I felt like I was in a war zone. And I called my news director. Well, my news director is on the phone with me. And I'm screaming, saying, I've been shot. Like, I need help. no one could get to me because the police had kettled the area. It was really scary. It was really, really scary.
Now, also, I don't know if this is a report a lot. Maybe it is. I feel like I've read this many times, but those bullets are only supposed to be shot at the ground to make people disperse. They are not supposed to be shot at people, but that clearly, that sort of regulation in quotes, has gone out the window pretty quickly as cops are fucked. But how did KCRW deal with what happened to you?
They didn't. They really didn't. So as this was going on, just something to keep in mind in the background, the employees at KCRW were unionizing, and I had become very vocal in that struggle and that fight. Sometimes even butting heads with the union because, you know, they hadn't done things that I thought were foundational to forming a union, like serving employees about pay on a basis of like race and, you know, I just like different identities, like queer identity, that sort of thing that hadn't been done. There were some things that I wanted done just as far as protections that the union wasn't in line with. So I had basically become a very loud person advocating for the rights of employees. So that's going on in the background.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I got shot. I reached out to my news director as well as the chief content officer and let them know what had happened. I sent photos of my injuries. They told me that they filed a complaint with the Office of the Inspector General. And at that point, a police officer reached out to me directly and asked me to come and be interviewed by him alone. And I wasn't comfortable doing that.
Yeah.
That sounded to me like I was being questioned for a crime, just like the way his email was written. Yeah. It was written like I had done something wrong. I wasn't comfortable with that. So I reached out to KCRW and said, hey, you know, like, I'd love if a lawyer could come with me if this is like what needs to happen. I just don't feel comfortable doing this by myself. And they told me no. They told me that they wouldn't give me a lawyer. And they told me that I was perfectly fine to go down to the police station alone. And that, why was I questioning the police? Like, he was just doing his job and to, you know, everything was all right. So I reached out to an old family friend who is a very well-known entertainment attorney. I just explained the situation to her and she said, that's ridiculous. Under no circumstances should you speak to law enforcement alone. You shouldn't even be speaking to law enforcement about something like this.
After like, getting you didn't shot do anything by them? Wrong. Like,
yeah.
Oh my God.
Her point was, you didn't do anything wrong. Of like, this is ridiculous. And she sent a letter to Jennifer Farrow and to Paul Benham just saying, like, y'all are on some bullshit in her legalese. And they gave me a lawyer. Wow. After that letter was sent, after I had a white woman tell them that what they were doing was wrong.
For telling a black woman that she, why would you question police? You can go there by yourself. Like, my God, this is already enraging me.
My favorite is, why are you questioning the police?
Yes, exactly. Like, why aren't you? Like, come on, man. Like, what? Get with it.
Why are we questioning the people who shot me? I don't know about you.
Have a lot more to get into, but let's leave a little cliffhanger, you know, take our second break. We'll be right back. And we are back. We just left you on a cliffhanger, if you remember. Sorry. And you were talking about that they finally gave you a lawyer after you had a white lawyer tell them to. So what was the response after that?
You know, I really liked the lawyer. I had a good experience with her for the most part. She was very communicative with me. I felt that she was really being an advocate on my part. You know, I think that where things stand today as a result of what the station did, I took a buyout after the union was recognized and fully signed the contract, deal was done, everything. The station offered everybody a buyout, a voluntary buyout. They said it was not the result of us unionizing, but, you know, so I was really torn at that point. I wanted to leave because I felt like everyone hated me in management. Jeez. And, you know, the way things have gone since, I think that's been demonstrated as true.
Yeah.
And it had sort of been communicated to me in so many words that jobs that were redundant would be eliminated and that perhaps my job would be one of those redundancies. So I felt, and I still feel kind of this like really overwhelming sense of responsibility to take care of everybody at KCRW, because I was the one that was saying things that other people maybe were thinking but didn't feel comfortable enough to say. Mm-hmm. I was the one pushing for things that people wanted but maybe didn't feel comfortable enough sticking their neck out. I felt like if I were going to leave, who would be the person to look out for everybody and take mm-hmm. care of them? So it just basically got to be too much. And I had to, you know, speak with my therapist, speak with my girlfriend, and just ultimately make the choice to choose myself and my sanity over other people, because what good can I be to the world if, you know, I'm not right within myself? Yeah.
I mean, I've been in that position before where you feel like you have to speak up. I know how that feels when there's like the looks people give you when you say something that you think mm-hmm. is important. I remember there was such like before everything happened, before I felt comfortable, like, you know, when I was speaking up and then I was basically low key told like, you need to start behaving. Like I the word behave was used and I was like, OK, I see how it is. Like, you're telling me to behave. You are just annoying everyone. And you're like, OK.
Okay. How do you think I feel?
Yeah. Like, I just, they would never tell a white cis man to behave. But that's the issue here.
They don't like, say shit like that.
Yeah.
Sorry, my dog is.
No, go ahead.
No, look, we are.
Can
we're
you
very,
shut up, Shiloh?
We're very animal paws here because all our animals are making a mess.
Can you shut up? I love that.
She's laying in bed with my pet snake and just started.
You got a pet
barking.
Snake in the bed?
What?
Yeah,
and they lie down together?
They cuddle?
Yeah.
Wait, your snake cuddles with your dog?
Mm-hmm. Wait, so
that's beautiful.
That is fascinating because I didn't even know dogs knew what snakes are. Maybe they do.
I don't know if she knows what he is.
Yeah.
But
I
they're
think
friends.
If they've acclimated to each other, like I can see like them being freaked out initially of each other, both of them. But then they become friends. Oh my God, I want to see this like Pixar
now,
movie.
Are you?
I'll send you a picture
with
my audio.
How so is your snake free to like roam around the house? Or do you
not
just bring him out?
Always.
Okay.
Like right now, we're like just getting back from like being on the run from the sheriff's department.
Right.
And the snake was home. He wasn't by himself because we had people like checking in on him.
Yeah.
But I just like let him out so he could, you know, visit with everyone.
Stretch,
he missed us.
Stretch his leg.
Stretch his muscle.
Stretch his body.
Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Can't wait to see this
we
photo.
Digress.
Cannot wait to see this photo.
I'm sorry,
of
I was
your
just really fascinated by that concept. The snake.
Because you just said
dog.
It so casually. You were just like, my dog is lying with my snake. And I was like, what?
I'm sorry.
Repeat?
Okay, we need to stop this talk about racial issues within the workplace. What did you say? that's really cool. Okay, where were we? Yes. So, I mean, also, that's kind of amazing to me that, like, KCRW never, like, figured it out. Because when
after all this time,
so
you've been established for ages.
Yeah. So you leave, you take the buyout. Now, when did you decide to speak out about your experiences with them?
I had been. I tweeted about being stopped entering my job, and some employees reached out to me after seeing my tweet. My boss also pulled me aside after I tweeted and told me to come to him first about stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the reason I tweeted about it and didn't like go to anyone in management is because I had been stopped by multiple employees already, right? So I didn't really feel like this was something that would be well received.
Right.
After that, I mean, the problem was never addressed. They said that they would update their employee handbook with a policy for how to verify employees, which I think is just like bullshit. I don't think you should ask employees to police each other. If there's generally a security concern, you can hire a security guard, someone who's a professional. So yeah, I mean, I had been speaking out. When I left, I sent a letter to the staff just talking about the racism that I experienced, the homophobia that I had experienced, the transphobia that I had experienced and witnessed, and just spelled out for them, like, hey, like this, like I've called attention to this. I've done what I can do. Like they had implemented policies that I had suggested in like the guidebook, for example, but there hadn't been any follow up. And I just basically said, like, I've done my piece. Like now, you know, I hope that you all will continue my work. And there was a meeting that was held after I sent that email that employees told me about, where KCRW said that they wanted to address claims made, but they never mentioned my name or my email in that mm-hmm. meeting. And things just sort of like sat like that for a while. And I was happy, like, having them out of my life. My mental health was a lot better. I was a lot happier. I was getting to do stories that I cared about without being constantly questioned about why it was important or valid. Mm-hmm. But then earlier this year, KCRW launched a series called My Black LA, which is a very problematic title when you think about who is making that content uh-huh. over at KCRW, yeah. which by my count has zero Black employees wow. in editorial. Anyway.
So a bunch of white people are making, or non-Black people rather, probably all, mostly white people are making a show
called... Oh, it's called, all white. We, okay. KCRW has like a handful of Latinx employees, a handful of Asian employees. I want to say less than 10. It's mostly white. I want to say it's like 90% white, but like I'm not confident saying that it's mostly white. Mm-hmm. It's mostly white.
Yeah.
It's like their version of the Black Square on Instagram.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah. So you saw that show being made, and did that kind of catapult you into being like, I need to get this on paper?
I saw that show being made, and not only was that show being made, but that show was being made with ideas for a show that I had pitched.
No.
The prior year, and was told that there was no resources to create a homegrown show.
Wow.
I mean, color be stupid, but I thought radio stations were in the businesses of producing homegrown shows.
Yeah. Especially this like hometown, very lauded thing. God, fuck them, man. Wow, I hate them so much. I was going to ask, when you sent that letter to the staff, did any staff members respond to you directly, or was it kind of just...
Tons.
Yeah.
Tons. Tons did. Tons told me that... And it was really... Honestly, it was really reaffirming to hear from people, because I really felt most of the time that when I was raising issues with management and even with the union, that maybe I was just like doing something that nobody wanted.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That, you know, I was advocating so hard, but nobody like cared. So it was really, really nice to hear from so many people being like, I always admired what you were doing. I always thought you were brave. And now I feel like I have to take up your mantle. I mean, that's really what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So it was great to hear.
Yeah. I'm glad that you did that. I'm glad that you got that kind of response from some people. And I'm glad that you left. Fuck all of them, especially the ones in charge. I mean, not the ones that responded. They're okay. But ugh, it's just so hyped up. And I hate the image. I hate how well-liked the image is of that they have presented of themselves, and just how much of a facade it all is. Also, I hate that they used a pitch that you, as a Black woman, pitched yeah. for a show that would have been probably more make sense if you, a Black person was involved, but to have that...
It had a much better title, I'm just gonna say.
I'm sure. But the fact that, like, they know that you had a terrible experience, you wrote them about it, and then they went back and were like, Black Lives Matter is getting some attention right now. Remember that Black woman that used to work with us? She had a good idea. Like, let's go there. Like, it's just like, what? Like, I can't.
But since we bought her out, she doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't exist. They had a meeting following my appearance on the LA podcast and again, right, didn't mention my name.
Wow.
But they did say that the person making the claims was a liar, despite the fact I have over 50,000 emails documenting mm-hmm. all the shit that I went through.
They're,
you know,
garbage.
Yeah,
garbage.
They doubled down on being completely, I don't know, white supremacist as fuck. I don't even, I don't get it, because to me it's like, it's so easy to learn. It's just like, it's our basis of growth is just learn. What did you do when you were growing up? You went to school. Why? Just so you could learn something. Mm-hmm. So to be like, oh, well, this black woman felt that we were doing things that were clearly white supremacist, clearly just fucked up behavior. And we were like, I didn't like see it that way. It's like, yeah, that's the point. You're not seeing it that way because you are so deeply engrossed in this white supremacist system in this world that was created for you that, yeah, of course you're not seeing it that way. But someone who does not have your experience, doesn't look like you, who has a whole different world they came from, is telling you something, and yet you just dismiss it when you could just be like, that's interesting. I didn't know that because I'm not you.
Yeah.
I don't have your life. I don't know your experiences. I don't see what you see. It's just so easy to be like, oh, I didn't know.
Yeah.
I genuinely didn't know, but now I do. Wow.
Yeah. I think a symptom of white supremacy and racism and this like very insidious kind of like supremacy and privilege is that because the status quo has always been with white people, they just assume their world is the world. Like they just assume like, well, I don't feel that way. I never got stopped at a gas station. That doesn't happen. It's like this very subtle symptom of privilege that they're convinced that the world that they've experienced is the world, because as far as they're concerned, that's what it is. In media and television and film, their world is the world. Everything else is sidelined, othered. So it's a disgusting way that it's just a way it perpetuates. And it's the hope is that people are smart enough to be like, that's not my experience. I should maybe try to understand. Even though I never have lived this, my world isn't the only world, you know? It's I don't know. I maybe that's a little bit too philosophical or something, but I do think there's an element there where these people that maybe are like, I'm not racist, they still have a racist worldview that is perpetuated, you know?
100%. Jennifer Farrow, who is the president of KCRW, after I made a comment in a magazine, in Variety magazine, about my experience being shot as a Black reporter, she pulled me aside and said, I hope that you don't feel that you've experienced anything racist here at KCRW. You remind me so much of my Black daughter. You even look like my Black daughter. Always wanting to tell me about her Black children.
Are you kidding me?
What?
It's like they parody themselves. I swear to God. Like,
what?
Who says that?
My Black daughter. Just FYI, I have a Black daughter.
Yeah.
It's like okay, you're gay?
I have a gay friend. That's happened to me multiple times.
God. You know, growing up, as a bit of an aside, growing up as a little Persian girl, I didn't fit in anywhere. I was fucking weird. I just didn't grow up around any other Persians or brown people at all. Or, well, I grew up around like Asian people, Black people, white people. There was no like Arab and or Persian people around me. Not even any like Indian people. I don't know. Just the place I was, it's just no brown people. And I of course knew I didn't fit in. Obviously, I was a fucking weirdo. But I didn't know about, like, Islamophobia. Like, I just didn't know. I was like, I don't know, it was a thing. And then 9/11 happened. I'm 11. I'm like, oh, do people hate us? And my parents had to be like, oh, people hate you. People hate all of us. And, like, I had to, like, at a very young age, like, truly, like, I didn't know. I didn't know my, like, you know, I'm very white passing. So to me, I was like, I didn't know. But my dad is dark. So, like, I didn't know his experience. So, like, I'd always be like, why is dad always being so dramatic? As a kid, my dad, notorious for throwing a fit to get what he wants. because I think he like passed a threshold at one point, was like, I don't give a fuck anymore. And so I'd always be like, why is he always like this? Like, why does he always have to prove a point? And then 9/11 happened and I was like, oh, because everyone takes one look at him and has his their judgment. And so he's always trying to like be like, that's not it. And I'm going to make a point as to that. So like I had to learn that my own people are seen a certain way. And like, I just had to, like, I didn't know my dad's own experience being a darker brown man in America, like how he's treated. And also my mom, very incredibly white passing, just happens to be the palest Persian woman you'll ever see. Just how it is. She also has light colored hair. People don't know she's Persian. How also within the community, the colorism of people of color, how they treat my dad compared to how they treat my mom. I had to learn all of this. I'd always be like, why is my mom so defensive of my father? Like, he's kind of an asshole, you know? Like, I'd be like, why is she always defending him? And it's like, oh, because she's trying to make a point that you can't treat people like that. Like, I had to learn all of this. Yeah. And I didn't know. I think I'm part of it.
I mean, I think that can resonate with a lot of children of immigrants. Like, I can definitely relate to elements of that, too, where it's like, and it's really tragic that, like, 9/11 for Middle Easterners was this big boiling point where suddenly you've realized like, oh, especially like for us, we were like 11, the world is bad for us. And I got, my mom had her hair covered at the time. I was terrified of her going outside, going to the mall.
But did you ever feel, because I always felt like it was just deeply white supremacist ingrained within myself as my childhood because I just wanted to fit in. Did you ever feel embarrassed by your mom covering up?
Yeah, I was embarrassed for a lot of reasons. Sometimes my parents had accents. I felt like weird about them talking to my friends. My mom was a lunch lady at the school, middle school, during 9/11, like during that time period of my life. And I didn't like that I was that exposed, both financially, but also just like as an Arab kid. Yeah, there was a lot of elements there. And that's why I think like as an adult, I really appreciate my parents. And I always try to remind myself like, forgive yourself for the ignorance you had as a kid that were the symptoms of a white supremacist culture and just do better now. Because I think you're right. There's so much colorism that even I felt, you know, like even I was terrified of getting dark. I get dark very easily and I'm the darkest one. I've always been kind of like growing up. I was always the tannest one out of my sisters. And so I got petrified of the sun. I would always stand in shade. I hated going outside, wearing long sleeves. I didn't want to get dark because in Arabic, it's like like Middle Eastern culture, if they call you tan, it's not very, it doesn't have a nice connotation. So I also had to like very much undo these almost survival tactics that I had implemented. It was you trying to survive as a child, as a teenager even. So I try to be nice to that younger version of myself and forgiving because What did we know? We didn't know anything better because I also didn't grow up around a lot of Middle Easterners. I was a weirdo.
Best thing is you learned and you can be like, well, I didn't know that perspective.
Yeah,
and now
exactly.
I do.
Yeah.
It's okay to have had a different perspective and not realize that you were in your bubble. It's like, that's what things like white people, like, I don't know what it is. Some white people can't do it. Mm-hmm. It's just surreal.
Can any? I don't think I've met one that's completely left the bubble.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't know
like
what
completely
it is.
Out of the bubble. No.
There's like, always 1 foot kind of nearby. Yeah. You know, there's just like a little toe. It's just even the best ones have like something that they say. Like even my friends, good friends of mine, sometimes they'll say like one thing that I like that was kind of off. Like, I love you, but what was that? Like,
you always have to have one eye.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. But your family's like assimilated. You're like, what the fuck, bitch?
That is not a good thing to say to anybody.
I had a friend say that too. He's like, well, you're cool because your family's like assimilated. And I was like, fuck you. You don't even know what that means. Like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah.
Like, I'm cool because what? My parents are still from a different country. They moved here. Like, what do you mean I'm cool? Because I'm somewhat more, I don't even know, like, that kind of shit is like, fuck off. I've had people be like, oh my God, you should be careful when Trump got elected, being like, you don't want to, like, lose your citizenship. And I'd be like,
what?
I had that same, oh my God. Trump being elected, what? Everything in the Syria
travel ban. They were like, you should be careful. You don't want to lose your naturalization. I had a friend say that. Wait, and I was what? Like, I was born here, bitch. What do you mean?
Yeah, literally, like after
crazy.
I think starting from like 2010, ever since ISIS came to be, maybe even earlier than that, when people meet me and one, they figure out I'm Middle Eastern, especially if they figure out I'm from Syria, the first question they ask, strangers, anybody, what do you think of ISIS?
What?
Like, I
God. It's so crazy to hear how like people be racist to like other races and just always like, what the fuck? Like,
they're just shameless. It's really appalling and just, yeah. I think that's why so many people of color kind of have, this is like, there's like a threshold that you just have to come to eventually realize, like, y'all can't change. I'm good here. Like, figure it out yourself. You reach like a boiling point where you're just like, I've had enough. Because there's only so much like chopping away at you that they can do, you know?
But like, they refuse to change and then they expect us after a while to not say anything. That's the wildest part to me. It's like, why do you just keep, why do you want, like, why, first of all, where in your mind do you think, but they're not, like, why would they complain? It's like, well, I'm complaining because, you know, it's just like been a really long time of the same old shit. And I don't want it to keep going because one day I hope to have kids and maybe they'll look like some sort of way and then you'll create more assumptions about them. It's like, maybe I just don't want this shit to continue.
Yeah.
Maybe we want KCRW to fucking look at a person of color and not have an assumption about who they are, what they are, what kind of work they can produce.
Yeah, exactly. And I really wish in our lifetime that we see these quote unquote good institutions, good companies, good white people do more than just this like surface level bullshit. Like, we, like, the fact that like we still have so many companies that have like a diversity panel, like it's like their attempt at representation and inclusivity is just like further singling out these people of color to the fact that it's like, we're doing it. Look at us. And I just hope within our lifetime that we have these actual progressive institutions that practice what they preach, that aren't just for show, because it kind of gives these people a pass that they listen to this progressive, it's like talking about KCRW, these people that listen to this progressive news station in their mind. So they don't think they're really doing anything wrong. They don't know these practices that are going on behind the scenes because they trust this institution that's been like drilled into their head as being this like nonprofit, homegrown, like for you progressive bullshit, but it's really not. So, and there are so many companies like that.
How eclectic is that fucking music? You know, like, fuck them.
Yeah. I mean, they have a no rap policy. So,
wait, seriously?
Well, why would you ever have rap on KCRW?
Wait, I didn't know that.
Terrible.
Oh my God.
It's not eclectic enough, unfortunately.
They'll play like certain things, like the Megan Thee Stallion song with phony people, but like, like hip hop, like, no, you can't play.
Stupid.
That is 100% just
straight
racist.
Straight up losers as well. On top of like all the racist bullshit, like, what a bunch of losers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to just bully them for the rest of my life now.
Thank you for standing by with us as we both vented.
As we cried. As we cried. You like,
no, I mean,
Cerise, thanks for understanding.
But this has been a very important conversation. And again, you're doing very important work. And I'm so glad our listeners got to know you a little bit better. And I want everyone to know where they can find you online, where they can follow your work, especially the history of violence that you're ongoing.
We'll link everything in the description as well. So
yes,
but please.
Yeah, you can follow me online. You can find me just, you know, at my name, Cerise Castle. And I would also say that, you know, if your listeners are enjoying A History of Violence or, you know, any of the reporting that's happening at NOC LA, it's all donation funded and the work is very expensive to do. For Tradition of Violence, we spent over $3,000 trying to get our hands on these court documents and make them available to the public. So if you're able to chip in a dollar or two so we can continue making all of those good things happen, please shoot us a buck on the NOC Patreon.
Thank you for saying that. That's good.
I want to say, like, NOC LA is like, I honestly like use them for like my real news, like mm-hmm. my real progressive news. I use them as like my voting guide. Like I use Knock LA because in Echo Park, Los Angeles, California, maybe you read about it. Maybe you didn't because it's not like anyone's reporting on it. We had a unhoused community at the park where the lake is. And basically Mitch O'Farrell, LA City Council member / dumpster, decided to come in and use the LAPD to aggressively remove a bunch of protesters, reporters, even the fucking blonde lady from Spectrum News got removed. Like yeah. people where you're like, that blonde bitch, she is the least threatening person ever. Yeah. They're silencing everyone and then literally flipping it to be like, guys, everyone was there like stopping us from housing these people. Can you believe it? The protesters were the issues. Anyway, bunch of bullshit came out. Mitch O'Farrell put out a bunch of bullshit on his Twitter, which fuck that guy, report it. And Knock LA was out there actually reporting on it. Jamie Loftus had a great piece in there. They arrested two Knock LA reporters who then report on their whole situation. Like, go read what's really happening at Knock LA. Like, mm-hmm. You can read the LA Times. Fuck the
LA Times. Garbage.
Fuck the LA Times. They're out here like paywall, and it's like whatever. Cool.
You need money,
but like don't pay for an LA Times paywall. Go put your money towards Knock LA, who's actually doing the work.
Yes.
Okay, they are fucking on the ground, telling you the truth, doing critical thinking, which you are not going to see in the mainstream media. So. That's the type of people we need to be supporting, because those are the type of people that I was talking about earlier that are making the push that we can have like real. I mean, it's the fucking, you know, like it's like socialist ideals, obviously, but like we want real people taking care of real people and not just like what our status quo is now, which is like, let's just like be cool.
Every payroll situation, like LA Times, New York Times, I despise it because they're making knowledge into this elitist bullshit. Like, I really, really despise that shit. And so getting involved in Knock LA, contributing to them as much as you can, if you can, is much more important than just like subscribing to something because you think it's like the nation's paper.
A status symbol.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Jamie Loftus's piece at Knock LA was so good. I live in Echo Park and I was hearing a bunch of bullshit. My landlady was literally bought the whole narrative that the cops were there to help and everything. I just like couldn't take it. So I really appreciated the people that were just there. I was like on the outskirts, like trying to just like to help for like evac purposes. But
so there you go.
I really appreciate that kind of work. And
they cover real
again,
shit.
Like as Anna said, like voting guides, everything. Knock LA is the shit.
Yeah. So support real journalists, real journalists. Yeah. I'm not to insult other journalists, but like people who, you know, look, you got the Deputy Gangs piece that Cerise wrote and is writing. There's more information, baby. You got them covering real shit in the city of LA. Like you can also like find other organizations that are doing the same thing in your cities as well. It takes a minute. You got to look it up. You got to Google. Yeah. Sorry to tell you to
but
use Google,
but
you'll
but
find it. And it's worth it. And support those organizations. Organizations like Unicorn Riot, like who are like on the streets live streaming protests in Portland. And whoa,
yeah.
I like forgot. Minnesota. Oh my God. I couldn't, not Minneapolis. Minneapolis. Sorry. I couldn't remember the name of that. Wow. All right. It's hot in my house. We kept you way too long, Cerise. So we're going to let you go.
Yes.
Follow Cerise. Twitter. Is it the same on Instagram?
It's a different username, but you can find me by searching
my
name.
Perfect.
I'm the one and only Cerise Castle.
Oh,
there you go.
That
one
is,
and only.
Again, household name. That's going to be you. That's what, like Oprah. That's one name. You know, come on.
Oprah,
anyways.
Also low-key white supremacist. What are you going to do?
I just gave an example of no one else ever being called Oprah. That's all. No, I know.
That's unfortunate. Once you get to a certain place, you're like, I'm sorry, I'm rich now.
Yeah.
So I don't care.
Yeah, it is very... I tried to have this conversation with someone and I was almost like burned at the stake. So I haven't brought it up since. But
people love
Oprah. Anyway, thank you so much for being our guest today. It's, again, the work you're doing is so important, and I can't wait for people to read more about it. Go follow A Tradition of Violence and follow Cerith on all socials, please. Keep up with her work. I'm going to wrap us out of here. This is Ethnically Ambiguous, Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I am Shireen. It's Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm at Anna Hosey on Twitter. And my Instagram is private. But I don't even really post anymore because y'all have killed my soul, okay? I'm scared of the internet.
I mean, who is it? But yeah, thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.